But I said, God, we did a first flight of something. There it is, 83. Got it.
And I've got my Delta flying colonel's credentials in the other room. Never heard of that?
No.
They made me one of these things. They first came to Portland in the early 80s,
mm-hmm.
and then they began the Japanese flight later. So what I tried to half organize it, and I realized it was overwhelming when I got into it.
Mm-hmm.
The final box yesterday that had just tons of small stuff.
Yeah.
That pile over there focuses on the television series Morgan with Love.
Good.
Which I assume you know.
Yes.
This stuff, and there's more of it, but that is Expo 86, including the final report in that binder.
Oh, good.
Which I think...
I was just writing about the governor talking about the final report he would soon receive.
And there it is.
Uh-huh.
Tons of other
uh-huh.
small minutia and things that go with that. Ron Allen, who was one of the members of the committee from Pacific Northwest Bell at the time,
uh-huh.
lived down the street on the other side of the
uh-huh.
street. Until about 6 months ago, and he and Carol moved down to Charbonneau.
Huh.
But there are photos in that book and elsewhere of Ron was a big athlete, and he was sort of the leader by PNB's sponsored
right.
friendship relay.
So, yeah, I was wondering, I just did the relay as they arrived, 2,000 miles.
Yep. So you get the idea.
Yeah.
There's Oregon Day and all the rest.
Yeah.
So this is Expo 86 with
uh-huh.
more I can dig out at many
mm-hmm.
places. This is a lot of stuff about many years. 7 different years they did
mm-hmm.
Morgan with Love.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a combination of stuff. These are sort of the photo op things. This was
right.
in Japan. Do you know Butch Swindells, Charles Swindells?
I've met him, yeah.
You know,
I clearly am going to need to talk.
Yeah. And we took Charles to Japan for the first time.
Mm-hmm.
It was an interesting trip.
Yeah.
You're familiar with this?
I'm yeah,
sure.
Actually, the thorns gave me theirs.
Okay. And we handed those out, and this
mm-hmm.
was him giving it to Ambassador Mansfield.
To Mansfield,
mm-hmm.
yeah. This little thing about, by the end, Vic and Mike would just kind of close the door, have some coffee, and
oh, yeah.
sit back and talk.
And the funny thing about meeting with him was he would always serve you coffee.
Oh, yeah?
But it was always instant. It was sort of a humbling experience.
Mm-hmm.
The Consul General,
mm-hmm.
you can imagine all the stuff that
right.
is here. So that's kind of that.
Yeah.
I started going through and digging into business cards, and this is a wild guess, and I was probably inaccurate, but I conclude I may have 2,000 business cards.
Well, you were in a business card culture in business.
And it was hard to grasp.
Yeah.
When I start looking at it again. And
yeah.
then this is just an amalgamation of articles.
Right.
That this is what the hard part. When I finally got to the bottom of the last box, I found literally hundreds of photographs.
Uh-huh.
And tons of just newspaper stuff.
Wow.
Some of it I can identify, some I can't.
Mm-hmm.
But this is Fujian Province, our trip.
Mm-hmm.
The trade... trip
mm-hmm.
there, various other sites. This is the second visit, the whole photo book about the visit of the Kedon Ren,
right. right?
Led by Kurosawa, who was head of the, I think, IBJ
yeah.
in Japan,
yeah.
where the first, of course, was Akio Morita.
Yeah.
We have photos of the governor with Morita-san. Now, the best for me personally, but it also tells the story of EDD.
Uh-huh.
You just plant, so you don't have to come over here, but my mother. And what kind of triggered this is Sandy and I realized upstairs we had all this stuff, and my
yeah.
parents are both deceased, and
yeah.
we processed to accumulate family goods.
Yeah.
I had never looked at either of these scrapbooks. They actually go back all through my life and
right.
my sisters. But starting here in this one, this was a GPCBA thing,
mm-hmm.
me and Dave Heinold, who was the director at the time, and Jack Bradley.
Mm-hmm.
And then she pretty much took...
Clipped and clipped and clipped.
Clipped and clipped. This was a speech I gave in Joseph,
mm-hmm.
Lamar County, and the man in the foreground is my father.
That's great.
And there's a letter there that signifies one of the more personal experiences I had as EDD director when
mm-hmm.
we were able to provide lottery funds
mm-hmm.
to as an adjunct to local bond issues and federal EDA funds to put in a water and sewer treatment system that allowed them to move the water, I mean the sewer, around Lake Willow Lake.
Yeah, yeah.
Which until that time was becoming badly affected by the state park.
So that was one of the first real projects for the lottery.
It was one. And then there's, of course, John, who my original boss, went to Washington, so they created a battle of the bands, so to speak.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff about
exactly.
So throughout here are those kinds of stories. This, and she had clippings I couldn't find elsewhere about our Saturn effort, which was...
Yeah, which usually just a little blur, but it had to have been covered.
It was to some degree, but not a great deal.
Yeah.
But we hopped on a jet and flew to Detroit, like everybody in the nation was.
Exactly.
And there's a little coverage here on superconducting that, quite frankly, I can't find a lot of documentation.
Yeah.
So that kind of covers the broad spectrum of what's here. Now we can begin.
Amazing. So sit wherever you're comfortable.
Right now, okay.
And I'll just get the recorder pointing basically at you.
There you go. It's just glass. It doesn't much matter.
Yeah. So a little bit of what you just told me. How did you get into this business?
When I was, I'm terribly good or bad about detail.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a sophomore in college, I had moved from Oregon State back to Eastern Oregon University in those days, college, and I became a member of a singing group called the Ambassadors, sponsored by the university, to tour the state and promote the school.
Mm-hmm.
We mostly played at high schools and junior colleges.
Mm-hmm.
We were invited in the spring, I don't know what year it was, but it might have been 1971 or so, to go to Sun River.
Mm-hmm.
And we performed there for a conference that was taking place, and that was just very early in the life of Sun River. And the place stuck in my mind, and I could never not think about it a lot after I left the state. I graduated there. By that time, Sandy and I had married, and we had a son, and I went to Oregon State. I did a master's degree at OSU and graduated with that in 1975 and took a position at the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved cross-country, spent about 4 years in Madison. And at the end of the process, we realized that Madison and Wisconsin were a great place, but we were going to come back west.
Mm-hmm.
Sandy's company, she was working for a healthcare planning agency, and they were just had an absolute lock on a contract that was going to allow them to do what they did in the upper Midwest, but also do it now in Seattle. And so they wrote her into the contract, and our move back west was going to be facilitated by her organization, and I was resigning my position at the UW and decided that I didn't really want to stay in the higher ed field at the time. And all the time I thought about this experience, this Sun River, because it combined what I was familiar with growing up in the High Willows in town of Joseph and the environment I enjoyed, but in a really remarkable place, a planned community with all these available things. And we came back. Oh, they didn't get the contract. But by that time, we'd made our decision, and we said we're just going to move back to Oregon. And we did so without a job or any other plan except to get one. And we thought the most likely place to do it would be in Portland, so we managed to find an apartment through the Oregonian remotely out in the Beaverton area. And we moved into Portland and started thinking about jobs. But we read about a job in the paper that was open at Kaneda.
I'd
never been there, but of course knew about it. So we said, well, let's go. I think I called them or something. They said, we'll come and interview, and we did. And they offered me the job on the spot. We were intuitive enough to realize that may or may not have been the best fit.
Right.
But I had always thought about Sun River. I said, let's go down to Sun River. We're this far. So we drove to Sun River. And as we drove in, we saw the sign that said personnel, pointing to the right.
We drove over and we met the HR
director.
She said, well, we just had a position open, or we just had a walkout. They had fired a person and some others followed him. So they were in a bit of a fix at the moment, implying that maybe there was opportunity, but it was in the fall, October, and near the end of their typical season. But she introduced me to Hank Hickox, who was the young general manager of the resort division. And the position that they had just sort of vacated was in charge of all their conventions and convention management, which involved sales of and then just administration of stuff. And it was such a departure from anything I had done. He thought, oh, this guy's a, you know, he's come in the university field. How could you possibly translate that experience into this? But we came back, and I pretty much pestered him into finally hiring me. So we moved to Sun River in the late fall of 1978. And we loved Sun River. It was a great experience. But we also realized that for a long term, it really wasn't going to be where we wanted to be. With the sun, no school out there, a lot of things going on. And around that time, Greater Portland Convention and Visitors Association was born. And they created it, moved that function out of the Chamber of Commerce, and Portland established a room tax. It was a partial funding base. And I had gotten to know some of those people, and David Heinle, who was the new director they brought in, had recruited me to come up and establish a tourism marketing program, GPCBA. Now, in doing this, I found business cards from two of the British team of three whom I'd worked with at Sun River, who had started to want to market Sun River to the Brits. And I had had an initial experience with some Japanese traveling to Japan. And George Azumano was my first escort, if you will, to Japan. And we had fond memories of those things. So that was sort of an interesting early transition. I came up and began this new program of marketing tourism for the city of Portland, which inherently became the state of Oregon. And during the course of that, I got involved with the political engagement with moving the tourism marketing division into EDD. So having done that job, for about 3 years, all these things came to play. And when I, John Anderson, who was then Vic's director of economic development, came to, took me to lunch, and I said, well, no, I really don't have a desire to leave this to go run tourism for the state, but we did agree that I would be interested in, and he offered me the position of deputy. And at that point, they had one other deputy, Wayne Wolf, who was running administration and the finance programs. So I became accountable for the external marketing ones, which were tourism, film and video, international trade, ports, which were really a partially financing entity, and, of course, industrial recruiting. Those are the primary things. And that was in May 1984. Within days of that, or at least weeks, two major things were happening. I didn't know at the moment that I'd already been working to some extent with Doug Frangle, who was head of the International Trade Division, because of the work I'd been doing in Japan. And we realized that it's one thing to work, and I'd been working with United Airlines and various other collaborators. It's one thing to try and market inbound tourism to Oregon now that we had one direct flight and zero name recognition in Japan. But it's another to recognize that it's really a two-way street, and international trade was an established and growing function at the state level, representing and working with more and more firms in the state who wanted to export their products. Japan was obviously a large buyer, going way back to the days when Hutchison, for the Oregon wheat, I think it was the wheat growers.
Wheat growers were there in like 58. They established a place in Tokyo.
They did. And in fact,
so,
his Debbie, his daughter, and I worked at some point, and she was on one of our early trips to Japan, because Debbie's about a 6 foot tall blonde who spoke fluent Japanese.
There you go.
So you can imagine how much fun she had in Tokyo with the.
Yeah.
It was always a shock anytime you were with Japanese, and they, of course, assumed that you didn't know the language, and then when suddenly you exposed some knowledge of it, it would always be a... And she was probably the most fun to do that with, because they were always fascinated by her anyway.
Yeah.
But, so that was the beginning. Of course, timber, ag products were the primary exports, mm-hmm. but other things existed even at that time. Mm-hmm. Tektronix, mm-hmm. Sony Tech, mm-hmm. and their joint venture, and other things. So there was work going on, but it hadn't really very much resulted in any inbound development until mm-hmm. that almost that month. And at that point, the work had already begun with NEC.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, I believe it was in May of 84, you probably have this, when the Kadon, well, when Sony, Akio Morita.
Yeah, brought over the delegation. Yeah.
Brought the delegation, and I was involved with that. That was almost the first week I was in the job.
There you
so
go.
It was kind of a...
Welcome to probably the most powerful person in Japan.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And what a fascinating person.
Yeah.
In every way. So worldly.
Yeah.
And obviously spent time as a young man in America and in New York and then did what he did.
Yeah.
And as you obviously would know about the special session and the repeal of the unitary tax.
Mm-hmm.
So that was my introduction.
Mm-hmm.
And on the heels of that, we began immediately working with two Fujitsu companies, Fujitsu America
mm-hmm.
and Fujitsu Microelectronics.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was kind of the start of the industrial recruiting work and my engagement in that. It was fascinating even then because while Fujitsu Limited in Tokyo knew both of its companies were doing this work,
mm-hmm.
we were always told that neither one knew about the other at all.
Hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
as a sidebar, what I learned and what I'm sure you have learned from the governor and his position over the years, John Anderson had a history in military intelligence,
mm-hmm.
and he ran many aspects of the department in a similar fashion.
Mm-hmm.
It was interesting, kind of fun, and a little amusing at times with the level to which we would go to maintain secrecy, but I quickly came to appreciate the need for it
mm-hmm.
and had a variety of experiences that tested that
yeah.
over the next few years.
Yeah.
So we had code names for everything
yeah.
and then a list of code names. It's like keeping track of passwords today.
Yeah.
So here we were working, and we had to divide our teams, because the work and the locations were very different. Fujitsu America, Hillsboro,
mm-hmm.
Fujitsu Microelectronics ultimately made a very odd decision to separate themselves from the rest of the high-tech community
mm-hmm.
and look at the Troutdale Gresham area.
Mm-hmm.
But we ran those. Meanwhile, I had already been involved, and the first time I met Vic Attia,
mm-hmm.
Governor Attia, was thanks to the TV show from Oregon with Love.
Mm-hmm.
There's so much information on this, but Kiyoshi Nakamura is an employee of Osamono Agency,
mm-hmm.
still is, I believe. And one of Osamono's lines of business Kiyoshi ran was inbound summer stays by Japanese students, sort of a, you know, world experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what Kiyoshi did, but Kiyoshi is a very entrepreneurial guy. And in Japan one time, he saw the show, can't remember the name, but it was about this father with a daughter and a son who had lost their mother, and he had moved from Tokyo to the very northern part of Hokkaido.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was about them moving, adjusting from city life to rural life, living in the wilds and all these things. And Kiyoshi had the idea that why couldn't they do that in Oregon?
Mm-hmm.
Let me just a moment. I got
yeah.
to grab a book. If you,
yeah.
I don't know if you have copies of this, but if not, you will have them for the archive. So he managed to get a meeting with
mm-hmm.
the producer, Mr. Nakamura.
Mm-hmm.
and pitched the idea of doing something in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And he returned from Japan. I was in the office at GPCVA. He walked in and he told this thing to me, and he said, they're going to send a person to explore the idea.
Mm-hmm.
And Nakamura himself would come.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, we need to see what we can do to welcome him, to show him around, and it would be nice to get an audience with the governor.
Mm-hmm.
So I made that happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went down, we met with the governor,
mm-hmm.
and of course he did all the right things.
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of the beginning of this project. And then over the next few years, it became it took on a life of its own.
Yeah.
And this is the book that they produced that tells the story. I have two copies of that.
Uh-huh. That's great.
And so that was already in process. And one of the personal story that was amusing is our son was, 12-ish or so,
mm-hmm.
a little younger. And the writer came to Portland, and our job was to introduce him to the area. And
mm-hmm.
we did. And I remember he came to dinner one evening here in Lake Oswego. We lived in a different house. It was Halloween. And our son and his buddies were going to go out doing Halloween stuff, and there was a haunted house in
mm-hmm.
the community. So we took him, the writer, with our kids, and he experienced Halloween for the first time through the eyes of a 10 or 12-year-old kid in the haunted house. Later, one of the first earlier episodes
mm-hmm.
of From Warring With Love, of course, had to feature Halloween.
Yeah.
So that was the beginning, and it went on into the early 90s when they finished the seventh season
mm-hmm.
of that story. So these things were happening concurrently. And there were other things, tourism related, but by that time, of all those magazines, so many different publications had spent time here in Oregon. And I'd become friends with Mr. Ota, who owned five of those publications,
mm-hmm.
and his editor-in-chief of Travel Times, whose
mm-hmm.
name is Yasuo Saito, since passed away. He and I became good friends, and so routinely, Ota Publications, which they were both consumer and business-to-business,
mm-hmm.
four of the five publications were focused on restaurant, hotel, and hospitality industry issues,
mm-hmm.
and then Travel Times, the magazines that I have probably, I don't know how many copies of, were to the traveling public.
Mm-hmm.
And that was already starting to take hold in a way,
mm-hmm.
and we were constantly entertaining travel writers doing very specialized things. There's a whole series of books, probably four up here, that deal with jazz in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Portland has had a strong jazz scene for a small city all this time, and there's a whole section on Portland jazz in there.
Yeah.
And so I brought in, or received is a better way to put it, writers from various publications who came to experience these things. And
mm-hmm.
oftentimes they would do it up and down the West Coast.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. Travel Information Assistance Programs under the Department of State also is becoming active,
mm-hmm.
and based in Seattle had a director who was trying to build a collaborative effort to co-market three or four states within the region.
Mm-hmm.
We began doing that, and there was a big meeting in Seattle, I think called Powwow, probably in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
where many, many of these people came in, and then, of course, we sent them out into familiarization tours around the state. So I could go on and on, but all that was in place and happening when all the other began.
Right.
So
just what the impetus for this. I mean, we've got the flights. We're looking for two-way going back and forth. Is this more the Japanese saying, how do we get people on the flight? Is this more the airline itself saying, how do we fill seats? I mean, where does that impetus come from?
Well, initially, our partners at this end were, of course, United
mm-hmm.
Airlines, the Port of Portland, and
mm-hmm.
and our effort was, gee, let's at least, and frankly, I at Sun River had been one of the first people in the state to consider trying to export our product, if you will, by attracting visitors.
Seems like you've got some golf courses that would be very popular.
Truly, and a different, and it's funny how differently the Japanese looked at things from the British, for example.
Yeah, yeah.
The British wanted the guest ranch idea.
Yeah.
The Japanese were more focused on other things.
Yeah.
And in those days, their travel was generally group travel.
Right.
And kind of an odd fit. Oftentimes groups of young couples going out on their honeymoons together. Yeah. I mean, that was early. There's a position paper I found that I wrote. Must have been a good one, I'm sure. on GPCVA letterhead that I wrote to the State Trade and Economic Development Committee. Mm-hmm. And that was probably done in 1984.
Mm-hmm.
In which I basically break down the international markets, where we stand, what they need, and how they differ.
Mm-hmm.
And outline what would have been essentially a marketing plan for how to start to approach those. And
yeah.
So that document exists. I read it yesterday. I've forgotten I ever wrote it.
Uh-huh.
So in the case of the Japanese, to go back to your question,
yeah.
we began by wanting to do those things with United Airlines to try and make this flight work.
Right.
Because you had companies here that were doing export work and needed transportation. But it was only one flight a week.
Yeah.
Everything else was out of Seattle.
Yeah.
But what quickly happened is once we became engaged, and I look at a few key players,
mm-hmm.
and Yasuo Saito was one,
mm-hmm.
and then others, you realize we started to learn about the Japanese travel industry and how massive and sophisticated it was. And that's where, when I look back at the business cards I have,
mm-hmm.
Japan Travel Bureau... is just one example of so many specialized travel firms that packaged and sold travel abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And because very few Japanese at that time traveled individually, some businessmen, even businessmen oftentimes traveled in more
mm-hmm.
groups. So it was highly organized and structured. And so there's a very intact industry that was there to receive this kind
yeah.
of information, and they wanted new product. Simple as that.
Yeah.
And they had a new interest in the northern part of the West Coast because everyone in Japan knew about San Francisco and
right.
Los Angeles.
Right.
But they were starting to gain an interest in other things. And so they were. It was kind of a good time and place and an interest in expanding their markets.
Mm-hmm.
And so that began. It was sort of, I guess it was happy timing.
Yeah.
And a discovery of just how the Japanese were focused on that. Obviously, you have to look at George Asamano and George's bicultural
mm-hmm.
knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
He and I spent a Sunday with his aunt, who lived near Waseda University,
mm-hmm.
on our first trip there.
Mm-hmm.
One of the most kind of remarkable days in
mm-hmm.
Japan I ever had.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sho Dizono, who, of course, has
mm-hmm.
been a player in this field forever. And the port, everyone had an interest from this side, and then we discovered it on the other. So that was all going in volume in 1984. So by September of 1984, it all came together.
Yeah.
Co-announcements by the Fujitsus from Oregon with Love.
Mm-hmm.
And I have photos around here somewhere of an Oregon fair that we did
mm-hmm.
in down. It was at one of the stations. It wasn't, I think it was maybe Shinjuku area, but anyway, in Tokyo, where there was a whole street fair of
mm-hmm.
Oregon product. We had loggers doing
mm-hmm.
Chopping and loose-hauling
yeah.
and stuff. And we had various delegations who went to be there for that event. I can't remember how many people went, but it was
mm-hmm.
maybe 50 or more.
Mm-hmm.
Industrial, bankers, high tech, obviously wood products type people interested in tourism.
Mm-hmm.
So all were there doing things concurrently
mm-hmm.
on the trade mission that we ran in the fall of
1984.
Mm-hmm. And then it just continued on from there.
Yeah.
When I look at the dates and times and places of the photographs and the things that we did, 1985 must have been an unbelievable year.
Both 84 and 85.
Yeah.
I mean, one thing we're doing international is just trying to figure out, so when did Oregon governors start going overseas? What did it look like? And like the first major one is Hatfield and Antoinette go to Japan, meet the emperor. And then towards the end of his 8 years, they go to West Germany and France. And then McCall goes to East Asia. And wants to go more, but there's things pop up and things
mm-hmm.
like that. He He also wanted to lead the first state delegation anywhere to go to the Soviet Union, but that got the kibosh put on it. Straub, just one trip. But it's kind of one trip a term kind of thing.
Oh.
And E.T., his first term, he did two.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, he's reelected, and Katie barred the door.
It was all the time.
There are, you know, at least three big trips in 85. Yeah. You know, he'd get back. One, he got back, and a week later, he was gone, and boom, boom, boom.
Well, and so even in 84 was when we signed the Sister State Province Agreement with the Fujian Province
right.
and the PRC.
Right.
And I remember walking into that story, which is fascinating, especially to see it replayed with Trump these days.
Oh, yeah.
The Taiwan PRC dynamic.
I was telling a reporter I was talking to, he said, well, you're not going to believe this. But.
I know. I told somebody that the other day. I said, been there and done that.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a couple things like that. It's like, what are we going to do?
Yeah. Go figure.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That started in 84. And also, I believe that the governor signed the commitment, the proclamation or whatever, committing us to do Expo 86 in 84.
In 84, yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, I got that.
And then we formed, and these are obviously going to be available as well, but we began to form the organizations to make these things happen.
Right, right.
This program guide was interesting, but the one that, and this was the final report issued from my period, and there's an 84 annual report.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the archives you have those, but
oh, no.
This document sort of laid out the plans, division by division,
mm-hmm.
and it included things like Expo 86. So it first enumerated members of the committee.
The committee, yes. Called in the paper the bluest of the blue ribbons.
It was pretty darn blue if you look at the names on there.
Yeah, exactly.
It really was. And we got some seed money, $150 from the emergency fund run by the legislature, and then set out and started to build that.
Yeah.
I found a photo, I think it's up here, of me and the legislative leaders in Vancouver, B.C. We had to go up and look at the site and show it off to them because we were appealing for, ultimately became $2.5 million in lottery funds or something.
Yeah.
And we had a flight booked on the only carrier that flew into Vancouver, which is Western Airlines.
Uh-huh.
And we were all, I think the senior member of the party was Frank Roberts.
Mm-hmm.
And then a whole selection of other members of the committee. And I and Charlene Jackson, who was from Administrative Services. And we were waiting, and United or Western Airlines announced that they'd oversold the flight. We didn't have seats, not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to go.
Mm-hmm.
So I called, I don't know if I called him personally, but I called Aircraft at your call, Norm Winningstad.
Mm-hmm.
Norm Winningstad was such a partner in all these things in those days. And said, we got to get to Vancouver tonight. So they sent a jet to PDX, the private terminal.
Mm-hmm.
And we flew in that night and arrived at Vancouver sometime after midnight.
Mm-hmm.
Best customs clearing I ever had.
Yeah.
They came to us. And then this is the flight. It must have been the next day on the way going back, boarding the jet. And odd things came together on that flight because we kind of had to hop around the state delivering these legislators.
Right.
And we did that, and I was, by that time, this is where life makes a circle, Hank Hickox, who was also one of the reasons I left Sun River. Hank had left by that time and gone to Cuba Island, South Carolina, gone to Florida, gone to California, run Silverado, and had come back to Oregon to run Salishan for John Gray. And he was having a sort of big soiree at Salishan to be welcomed back.
Mm-hmm.
And we were invited, and I think Sandy was there, but had gone down on her own. And I knew all the staff from there, even from Sun River days, because we were sort of collaborating in our efforts. Mary Armstead was his VP of marketing. So the last person to get off the jet was me, and we landed in the the airport in Newport.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember this little Lear coming down over the ocean and circling, coming in. It was a foggy, kind of strange night. Touch down on the airstrip and run up to the end, and at the very end of the airstrip, there's a deer standing there looking at the headlights of this jet. It was a surreal experience.
Yeah.
And I and one of the legislators got off, and I snagged a ride up to Salishan.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of the intro to the whole Expo 86 story, mm-hmm. which played out mm-hmm. over the next couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
So all these things were happening early in this yeah. period of time.
Yeah.
Then 85 was kind of like time warp. It was just incredible, the number of trips and the number yeah. of places we went and the number the amount of activity. During that time would have been when we established the Tokyo office.
Yeah.
And David Luchin was posted there.
Yeah.
David, who is 6'4 or more, big, tall mm-hmm. guy, always wore a beard.
Mm-hmm.
Became affectionately known in Japan as the Bearded Barbarian.
Uh-huh.
And he just had a way of getting to know people and getting around.
Mm-hmm.
I remember David, we had a whole telex room in our, oh, I moved offices in our Portland. The office for economic, for external trade had been in the Pittock building. Our lease was up, and it was not a very convenient or useful location. Mm-hmm. And there was a dirt, there was a massive overabundance of office space in Portland at that mm-hmm. time. The U.S. Bank Tower was just opening. Mm-hmm. The PAC Trust Center was opening. Coin Center was opening, and mm-hmm. all had high vacancy rates. So we said, we got to find someplace easier and a little larger with more to facilitate more of our Portland work. Any one of those we could have walked into with amazing leases, but mm-hmm. I looked at all of them and said, the optics are not good.
Mm-hmm.
They're nice buildings, maybe a little nicer than we should have. So we went into the Crown Plaza
mm-hmm.
and made that move. So all those things were happening in that year. And there was a room dedicated in our offices there to telex. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the whole telex operator. And mm-hmm. the communication was painfully slow.
Yeah.
David discovered this thing in Japan that was a routine thing called a facsimile machine. And I think here, architects kind of use those things, but right. that was about the only profession right. I did. So we established our first set of telex machines,
mm-hmm.
and we could then communicate with David back and forth. And all of our regional offices,
mm-hmm.
we called these things the warlords,
uh-huh.
these guys. Suddenly they could no longer, they loved to use the excuse of always being left out of the loop. And
right.
headquarters didn't treat them with enough respect. Suddenly we gave them fax machines and darn it. Guess what?
Exactly.
It was just the opposite. Leave us alone.
In 1984, for the Fujian trip, Tom Atiyah was along.
Yes, he was.
And so he tells the story about Premier Zhao hearing that he was interested in rugs and saying, you're going to that city, and that turned out to be the city. Tom got home, incorporated. But as he puts it, China kind of went straight from rocks and things like that to faxes. And so he had one of the first faxes in downtown. He would run it out for $5 a page to attorneys who were beginning to do business in China and Japan and stuff. And it's like, there you go.
It was incredible. I mean, what a total leap in,
yeah.
in communication technology. Yeah. So, yeah, we began... And at that point, it's amazing when I start to think then about, notwithstanding time difference,
mm-hmm.
every day I'd come into the office and you'd have a message there, some yeah. of your messages yeah. from David and vice versa. So it was really, it was a remarkable time because we had to tee up the all of those activities. And then from a more personal standpoint, I had walked into that job in May of 1984. And mm-hmm. by sometime in the autumn, Wayne Wolf had decided to move to another agency.
Mm-hmm.
And rather than replace him, John asked me to take on everything. So I became mm-hmm. the sole deputy director to John mm-hmm. with all of the finance programs mm-hmm. as well as the marketing ones. And then I'll still remember the day, not the specific day of the month or the week, but the mm-hmm. day when John walked into my office and said, you're not going to like this, I mm-hmm. don't think. But Booth Gardner had been elected governor, mm-hmm. and John said, I'm going back to Washington.
Yeah.
And his word to me was something the effect of, if you want this job, take it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought about it for a relatively short time that day, and I walked into his office and said, when can you be out?
Mm-hmm.
And he was out.
Mm-hmm.
So I was named acting director, and mm-hmm. I knew they'd go through some process, which they did, and I think it took about 3 months. But the challenge was that this was literally a day or two before we had a sort of in-town roadshow lined up to introduce our priorities and budget requirements to the legislature.
Right.
And that was all scheduled for a theater in Salem. And so suddenly there's no John, it's just me and the crew. So the legislative session began, and with it, got to be one of the strangest sessions ever to take place for economic development, because mm-hmm. the lottery, of course, had been approved in 84. So with all these other things going on, the demands of having to be in Salem and the beck and call of the legislature and testifying and listening to testimony at mm-hmm. Trade and Economic Development Committee, mm-hmm. which is co-chaired by Joyce Cohen and Jim Hill,
mm-hmm.
was quite an experience.
Yeah, there was one trip. One of the trips was in May when the session was going,
mm-hmm.
and I think that's the investment trip. So it's you and Swindells, and the governor, and it's like three or four people are just going to meeting after meeting after meeting. But it's the planning stuff is make it very clear. This is contingent upon the fact that I probably may have to testify here and here.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
And to even make it more interesting, on the Japan side was, I believe it would have been that time, but maybe it was preceding that. Oh, it was probably September in 84 when the governor saw the itinerary, the schedule, the meeting mm-hmm. schedule in Japan. And he said, well, this isn't enough meetings.
Mm-hmm.
I believe the number maybe was somewhere around 20 or 25, mm-hmm. which was thought to be a reasonable number, given the transportation challenges and our relatively unknown status in Japan. Well, by the time we got there, it was something like 45 meetings in a week. It was really quite an accomplishment in itself.
Yeah.
And that all set the stage for so many more things that it was hard to even know what would happen.
Yeah.
So, 85 became that. So I had the legislative session. We had to discover what was going to get funded by the lottery. Mm-hmm. And at the end of that process, my agency, I think, came out with five different new bills mm-hmm. that were each for lottery funded, and we had to go through the public input and administrative rules creation,
mm-hmm.
but got there.
Mm-hmm.
I always felt some of those programs made a lot of sense
mm-hmm.
and gave very important tools that were necessary to most industrial sitings.
Yeah.
Others maybe not as much, but the one that had a lot of personal meaning to me in the end, that I had to recuse myself from involvement in this
mm-hmm.
because of my lifelong relationship with the area and the fact mm-hmm. that I still own a family cabin.
Oh, well, there we go.
Was this one. And it took 2 years for that to happen.
Yeah.
Because when the commissioners from the county came in and said, is there any way we can get lottery money? We had none to give.
Yeah.
So we sent them to intergovernmental, to Bob Montgomery and Yvonne Addington. And said maybe they have something, and they didn't. But a year later, and by that time, the City of Joseph and the property holders at Willow Lake had passed three separate bond issues to finance the creation of water system and the sewage collection and the mm-hmm. sewage processing.
Mm-hmm.
So all those things were magic, and then were matched with the money we were able to provide along with the federal government EDA grant. So it's... And that was predicated on two things that were job creators or salvagers. One was the saving of Willow Lake Lodge.
Right.
And the one that never took place, that was going to be new jobs, was the development at the, what would be commonly known as the Foot, the north mm-hmm. end of Willow Lake,
mm-hmm.
called Elk Trout Development, which was going to take, it was going to be a condo project.
Just kind of up on the
just
hill looking over the lake, kind of?
Up on the backside, you know where the dam is, where the Chief Joseph Monument is. Running down the hill on that little ridge below the monument. Kind of an odd spot. And it became kind of a lightning rod for a lot of things. I have a cousin who retired from teaching and became a county commissioner and county judge for many years and mm-hmm. had served on the planning commission. Mm-hmm. So Ben and I would always get together. His name is Ben Boswell. He was later the president of the Association of Oregon Counties.
Okay.
And became kind of a well-known figure in that world. So we'd always talk about the politics of land use planning, especially around Willow Lake, which is such a volatile topic area. So from a personal standpoint as well, we looked at that and said, wow, you know, I know what the requirements need to be, and I'm all for job creation. And at that time, had no idea just how much a place like Willow County was going to need to have jobs to replace the money that were lost.
Right.
But it never quite felt right. And, of course, now it's owned by the state.
Yeah.
It's a park.
Yeah.
It took many years, but it happened.
Yeah.
But anyway, we created that, and the Willow Lake Lodge has survived to this day, although this year, you may or may not know, it was sold as sort of almost a crowdfunding thing.
Yeah.
So it still continues through the years and survived. But more importantly, Willow Lake was saved.
Yeah.
My take on that was at about the age of 16, when the state built the current marina, and I had no idea what was going on, but I saw it, but I drove up one day, and they had put in a cofferdam to create an area that they were then going to pump dry, and then it became the landfill that became the parking lot and the marina. Prior to that, it was a riparian zone, cottonwoods and other trees that were water-friendly, and you could... It's kind of swampy and like any normal riparian zone. And what I realized when I drove up there that day is that with the cofferdam, what it became essentially was a sewer, because it's literally yards from the state park, and our cabins sit just above the state park, and every single place had its own septic system, and there were probably a multitude of water systems. And so that... At the age of 16, I was kind of shocked by that reality, and then over the years, realized, as did many, that the lake quality was gradually changing, but it hadn't reached a stage where the health department could declare it a hazard, and yet everyone knew that everyone, and probably more than anyone, the state itself, were contributing to the problem. So to me, when you think about those kinds of things that happen, it's kind of remarkable to know that one small tool, and it's not a lot of money.
Yeah.
Not by today's standards, it's nothing.
But it gives you the leverage.
But it's the leverage that those things provided.
Yeah.
So that became our job in the administration of lottery funds. Probably one of the more interesting ones that held for a time was this, which was taken in Lakeview. And they had five operating mills, but like many places in the state, rail lines were abandoning their branch lines.
Yeah.
And there was a 75-mile stretch to Alturas, California that supported all those timber products companies. And Burlington Northern Santa Fe were abandoning it. So the county put together a deal to purchase the line, and I flew down one day. It was a Saturday, and my son was out of school, and I had to charter a twin-engine plane to get there and back anyway, so I took Justin along. So he got to witness this whole little circus. On the end of the day, the two attorneys who came out of San Francisco for BN were trying to get home, and they're supposed to fly from Medford. They couldn't get to Medford. The weather was turning. Then they couldn't get to Eugene, so I said, we'll ride back to Portland with us, and you can get a flight from Portland. So they did, but we were going to Hillsborough, and they had to go to PDX. And I remember the pilot took us into an air strip at PDX I'd never used before, and we had a crosswind. And you can just tell when a flight's when you're in a bit of a risky situation. He got the wheels on the ground, pulled up to the terminal, opened the door. These guys hopped out, and he packed it up and took off again. We're going over the West Hills, bumpy, crazy flight. We finally land in Hillsborough, and the pilot lets out this gigantic sigh of relief, and he says, wow. He says, you know, I haven't been flying. I've been flying helicopters. I haven't flied fixed wing for quite a while. And I'm saying, and you let me bring my son on this? But we've always remembered that day.
Yeah.
So it became, from that point on, not only a business of trying to develop the lottery programs, but then the administration, mm-hmm. which became a whole other mm-hmm. task. There's a whole series of interesting printed articles. My assistant there, Betty Byes, was always good, even after I left the agency, in sort of cleaning up the pieces that came in and sending mm-hmm. them to me. And Alan mm-hmm. Oda, mm-hmm. who was kind of a, how would I put it kindly?
Well, let me put it this way. When the governor went to the Middle East, mm-hmm. Tom Attia and Alan Oda flew in together mm-hmm. to join them in Cairo. Mm-hmm. And Tom got out, who'd been to the Middle East a lot, and they shared a cab in, and the cab driver wanted about $80. And Tom said no, and so he bargained, mm-hmm. including taking stuff out of the back and all this kind of stuff. And Alan was mortified, just mortified. But told me, a little more starch than you would expect.
Yeah. Well, Alan was kind of a pest mm-hmm. to the agency. And we took him to Japan, or he, mm-hmm. he traveled us there. And, but you could always count on a certain attitude from, mm-hmm. from him that was, we felt, relatively unfair. Just throw that out of the way, please. And by the way, you can crank that back up behind you if it's a bit more comfortable like that.
Great.
That's what it's supposed to do. So anyway, the point is that of all the, you know, I looked at journalists through the years. Steve mm-hmm. Jennings sort mm-hmm. of took his bent on things. Julie mm-hmm. Tripp, Judy Rooks. And I ran into Judy and Bill Diaz, I think, was mm-hmm. her husband, at mm-hmm. The affair for Dolores Attia.
Oh, great.
So we looked at each other, and it took us a minute to recognize each other. And said, wow, it's been a long time.
Yeah.
We agreed we had some interesting times together.
Yes.
But Alan's focus was always more the negative than the positive, and mm-hmm. he wrote extensively about the lottery. Mm-hmm. And I haven't read them because the type's too small and I don't care anymore. Mm-hmm. But I've got a whole series of articles.
Yeah.
That was kind of his focus over the next couple of years.
Yeah.
So that's 85, and then it flowed into 86. By that time, we had created and built the pavilion for Expo 86. Can I take a brief break?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're welcome to just paw through anything around
here.
Yeah, no,
this is great stuff.
Track of all the sequences, but the two other things that 1985 really mm-hmm. caused us to do, mm-hmm. it was sort of course, more political than normal because of the session
right.
that was in place.
Right.
And a member of our commission at that time was Bob Baugh, who was AFL-CIO, I believe. Mm-hmm. And when GM announced the creation of the new company, Saturn, and the plan to build a plant somewhere in the country. It sparked a lot of interest. Now, of course, the only automotive industry that existed in Oregon, arguably, was Freightliner.
Yeah.
Which is not a lot to go on, but there's at least something. But there was a strong sense on the part of the union representation that we needed to make a play for Saturn. So we did. And that was one of those trips where we assembled a team of folks, higher ed and others, to look at that and put together a flight. Somebody lent us, or we borrowed a jet of some kind to fly to Detroit. We had, you know, by that time General Motors was very practiced in receiving delegations.
Yes, indeed.
And saying all the right things, patting them on the head and sending them away. So it was never something that I think we felt was highly likely, but we felt it was important and necessary to do it, and that article probably carries some of that message. So that took place, and then came the other big one, the superconducting super collider. And that was really a fascinating experience, partially because of the committee that we assembled, with the presidents of both universities, Olin and Byrne. And
more physicists than you would usually expect to see on the committee.
Typically, and John Gray, whom I knew from our first jobs at Sun River, and my wife worked for up to her retirement after she went through a few other organizations. So that became interesting and quite a challenge. I had to sort of educate myself just to know enough to know what the heck a collider really did and why.
Large circular hole.
Very much.
There you go.
And very large.
Yeah.
And, but then, of course, it's highly technical, complex, and very expensive to do if it were done. And the criteria, once again, did not really scream Oregon.
No.
Had to have great international flights and connections, be near a major research university, blah, blah, blah. Well,
I think earthquake faults might
could
be an issue.
Problem.
Yeah.
But I don't know, but we came up with two sites
that
our engineers said would work. And the most proximate, of course, was in the southern Willamette Valley. It would have gone under the Willamette River and under the foothills of the Cascades. And, of course, it would have been beautifully located between U of O and OSU.
Yeah.
The more practical, from a different standpoint, was out in the desert toward Hermiston, where we had a lot of land, even federal land. And digging a big tunnel would have been a different thing, although it would have been a lot of volcanic.
Yeah, a lot of basalt in there. Yeah.
Faults and structures.
Yeah.
So it was hard to know how realistic it ever was, but once again, we, these things took, in their own right, a lot of focus, a lot of attention, and the time of some amazing public-spirited citizens in the state of Oregon. So those were all going on that year. So we had Expo 86 forming and building, and the committee driving that, Saturn, and superconducting super collider. While in Japan, the activity was really kind of ratcheting up as well. And then, you know, when I kind of break it down after that, 1986 was a lot more of the same in travel. I found some handwritten notes that I had from a trip where we went, where we did go to Fujian province. Which was complicated by the number of stops we made along the way. Hong Kong.
Hong Kong to start there, back,
in Seoul. So, and,
and
quite a trip all in all.
You went to Xiamen during that trip, the special city. Did you guys realize what that was in terms of the Cold War?
Not really.
That's Amoy, as in Kemoy Amoy crisis. That was it.
That was it.
And so, but all of a sudden, because Taiwan's right across the straits anyway, but just you go in there, I was just like, oh my goodness. Another thing on those Taiwan trips, Vic talked to somebody named John Chang, who would be in the foreign ministry office of the Taiwanese. Did you meet him or?
I did not.
Okay.
Sandy?
Yeah.
How's the garage? Hi, I'm Jim.
It's just Sandy. Isn't this just the loveliest weather?
I got held up with the guys, and I was rushing to get home, and Jim was in the driveway when I got here, so I said, well, just pull it into the garage.
Oh, no, that was good, because now I have a spot, so it was perfect. Yeah. Otherwise, I was thinking, where will I park? Because I was assuming you'd be in the driveway.
I know, it's such a mess.
And well, just good. So you know, this is what Hillsborough, my house, looked like about 7 hours ago. And the snow's all gone now.
Oh,
so
yeah, it's coming.
It's coming.
I know, I can see a big difference in the last couple of hours.
I hope so.
Yeah.
But you can see I prepared for it up at the upper end of the driveway.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It can get crazy.
Crazy.
Well.
John Chang, yeah.
I don't think I met him.
Okay. Did you have any sense? Did the governor know who he was?
I don't know.
Okay. He's Chiang Kai-shek's grandson.
Chiang Kai-shek's grandson.
And wow. I don't think the governor knew. Jerry Thompson, who went on one of the Taiwan trips, because she and the governor actually made a pact because of the Rajneeshis,
mm-hmm.
that one or the other of them would always be in sail. Mm-hmm. And so she took one of the trips and the governor stayed.
Stayed.
Okay. And she met John Chang, and it turns out that he was, you know, greeted her and took her to a hotel that was actually important to the Chang dynasty kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But she had no idea.
Who is?
Yeah, and in the oral history, the governor did a really long oral history in the mm-hmm. early 90s. And everything else he goes through and corrects spelling, but he didn't correct that it was misspelled and he didn't correct it.
Hmm.
I don't think he knew that that was Chiang Kai-shek's grandson. So,
I never made it to Taiwan
because uh-huh.
that all preceded
yeah.
me. And at the time I got involved, our trade people were dealing with it all the time, but
yeah.
industrially otherwise, not so much. And we were just beginning then to open doors in for those purposes in South Korea, where
yeah.
we did go.
Yeah.
And of course, China. So I missed that. But I do, from the port, I still remember such a beautiful city, and the water there is remarkable.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember, I don't think I could actually see it, but we were told on the right day you could see Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just a ways offshore.
Yeah. And the island, the fighting was going on, and like the U.S. Air Force was flying over it in 1955. It was just, but they're only 5 miles apart.
Yeah.
It's the piece of Taiwan that's right on the coast.
Yeah.
And then there's Xiamen, which is right there.
Yeah, a friend of mine, well, actually, he's a relation. Is travel. My son goes to China all the time
mm-hmm.
in his business, and this young man does as well. And he told me, we saw him at Thanksgiving, he said, I finally made it to Xiamen.
Oh, yeah.
And he described it to me.
Mm-hmm.
I said, oh, my gosh. And he said, you know, they're moving to establish it as a free port.
Because it was a special economic zone
mm-hmm.
when you guys were playing around. Yes.
So now you'll have Singapore, Hong Kong, China.
Yeah.
Fascinating, but when we were there, you know, they had all the infrastructure. They had all these big, empty, light industrial buildings, a hotel, sort of Sheraton Life where we stayed, and then a small but very new and efficient-looking container terminal.
Yeah.
It didn't, as I recall, it wasn't large, but it was all brand new, and it was empty.
Yeah.
There were five companies that we visited that were doing kind of low-end assembly. One was doing some TVs and some other assemblies
mm-hmm.
for Hong Kong companies.
Mm-hmm.
A European company was doing ceramic, you know, dishes, that sort of thing,
mm-hmm.
flatware. Not a lot, but of course their sole goal was the obvious of let's get investment coming in here.
Right, exactly.
And it worked.
yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But that element of history was kind of lost on us.
Yeah. Well, it's because, especially because for the governor, Taiwan was so important to him.
Mm-hmm.
And but just, you know, little things.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, I don't know if you knew that connection there, but.
And I always kind of regretted not ever having the reason to get to Taiwan
mm-hmm.
in the midst of all this. But in
mm-hmm.
the end, it was such a short period of time, and Taiwan
oh, yeah.
so much
yeah.
going on.
It's just grand, just grand. In October '86,
mm-hmm.
so towards the end of the term.
Yep.
The election's going on between Norma and Neil. There's another trip to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
The first half is the governors. Atiyah goes, and he goes with the governor of Washington and New Mexico. They spend time with the LDP doing that. But then it's a two-week trip. But the second half, it's company,
mm-hmm.
company. Were you on that one at all, do you remember?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But what I'd have to do is go back and try to reconstruct what we did on that one. Because by that time, we had other companies
that
were moving along. And we had begun our engagement with, around that time, with Nippon Kokon, NKK,
mm-hmm.
which is the
mm-hmm.
final big, and actually the largest ever announced
mm-hmm.
in the U.S. in an article I just reread in my mother's scrapbook. It was the largest investment announced in the U.S. anywhere that year. It was $60+ million, mm-hmm. and by far the largest of any of those in Oregon. It mm-hmm. never took place. Mm-hmm. But we were so involved with that at the time, and it was at the transition of mm-hmm. governors, so it was complicated by that.
Yeah.
So I know we were doing that. NKK took us, I believe it was on that trip, to their sort of pride and joy. By that time, the South Koreans had become the largest steel manufacturers in the world, but mm-hmm. they'd taken that from the Japanese, and the way they did that was by offering more than the steel.
Mm-hmm.
They could both manufacture massive amounts of steel, but the South Koreans sold the steel with labor.
Mm-hmm.
And the largest buyers were probably in the Middle East and elsewhere. Mm-hmm. So they basically, maybe it's not kind to say it, but kind of offered slave labor that went
yeah.
with it.
Yeah.
You know, young men or men left home and lived in barracks and basically did construction.
Yeah.
So at that time, or not long before, the South Koreans had become world number one producer, but prior to that had been Japan and Nippon Kokon, probably mm-hmm. the largest of all them. In Tokyo, I'll say Tokyo Bay, but in the mm-hmm. river not far offshore, they had actually constructed their own island on which they built the factory and a terminal, mm-hmm. a shipping port, rather.
Mm-hmm.
And to reach it, you went through a sub and under a water tunnel.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember taking us out and seeing for the first time a real steel mill.
Yeah.
But probably one of the most advanced in the world at that time.
Yeah, absolutely.
So they were, you know, they were massive players.
Yeah.
And so they wanted to see what their history was, which of course was steel, but their goal was in moving beyond their old business and moving into a dimension of the high-tech sector,
mm-hmm.
which is what they had done or coming to do in the U.S. So that was part of that. And I can't tell if it was that year, but I'm guessing it might without double-checking. By that time, we had Epson
mm-hmm.
was here. And as mm-hmm. you know, Epson is Seiko.
Right.
And Hattori, there's another big story we've got to include in this, which was the visit of the Japan-U.S. Association to Oregon and Salishan. Do you have that story?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, I have to.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually is interesting because Sandy was somewhat involved in that
mm-hmm.
as well. But by that time, we knew all these people well and had good friends with each of the new companies that had come.
Mm-hmm.
And the folks from Epson Seiko wanted us to see what they do in Japan. And
mm-hmm.
so the governor and I, we may have had another staff person with us, were taken by them to their factories. And their factories are up in the mountains
mm-hmm.
North of Tokyo.
Mm-hmm.
And they flew us out in helicopters. And they have all these different factories in all these mountain communities in these lakes and mountains. And they hopped us around from one to another by helicopter to see these. And we spent the night in Ryokan
mm-hmm.
and spent time with their executives. And it was just remarkable just to see how they ran these. But one of the more interesting things was here they were building a computer peripherals plant, printers, was
mm-hmm.
one of their first products.
Mm-hmm.
We saw a factory there where they produced printers as well. And there was a high amount of automation. We saw a Seiko watch factory.
Mm-hmm.
It was virtually all automated. You looked at the floor where all these machines producing all the parts that went into housings that became the watch. And if there was a machine that was jammed or something, a light would on a
right.
pylon would flash and somebody would go take care of it. So everything was very advanced and automated, and we saw these different things. But I'll never forget when we toured their printer factory. You walked around sort of an outside corridor around
mm-hmm.
the factory floor. And in the corner of this corridor, there was a mimeograph machine.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the executive assistants was over there running off mimeographs for the business of the company.
Mm-hmm.
And we just looked at each other in disbelief. Out here, they're producing the most advanced PC peripherals
yeah.
and printers in the world.
Yeah.
But they're still using.
They had a bunch of mimeograph fluid they had to use.
Exactly. It was just a fascinating kind of
yeah.
juxtaposition of events. And so that was it was insightful and interesting and educational. It was a lot of it was just kind of a wonderful
mm-hmm.
experience delivered by them to the governor.
Yeah.
And this I'll have to double check the dates too, but this was kind of a big deal. In the course of getting to know all these people, and particularly Akio Morita.
Mm-hmm.
We had learned about the Japan-America Association. Mm-hmm. On the U.S. side, it was run by Stanford Research Institute, SRI.
Mm-hmm.
On the Japan side, Keidonren? This is where memory starts to fail me. So they were the facilitative organizers.
Mm-hmm.
And the program was basically business leaders in Japan and California. And they met each year, alternating between countries.
Mm-hmm.
But by this time, the Japanese had concluded that, you know, obviously they were moving manufacturing out of just, they were interested in states other than California, and
mm-hmm.
they wanted to expand their horizons, and now we had a number of them here. And the governor had probably proposed to Morita-san that, well, they should bring their next meeting to
mm-hmm.
Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
And we let that go, and one day I received a phone call in my office in Salem from Mr. Morita.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, was Governor Atiyo serious that we should bring that, to Oregon?
Mm-hmm.
I said, well, I'm sure he was, but I'll confirm that. So then a few minutes or an hour or so I did and responded
mm-hmm.
and said, absolutely, we'd love to host you in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
So it happened.
Mm-hmm.
And it became the first time when heads of businesses outside of California were
mm-hmm.
engaged with this, and it became the Japan West Coast Association at that
mm-hmm.
point. And we hosted it at Salishan. And the program was that everyone got into Portland. I remember there were all the big names, even in Oregon and Washington. George Weyerhaeuser personally
mm-hmm.
was there, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Came, and we first met and accumulated at the Benson Hotel, and then moved by motor coach down to Salishan.
Mm-hmm.
And the program was about 3 days, and you had a sort of plenary evening, nice dinner the first night. And the primary focus was on Saturday. It was in September, and it was the same Saturday as Pendleton Roundup
mm-hmm.
takes place.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, we had brought in they had simultaneous translators, and probably Portland, maybe it was Rose City Sound, had soundproof booths with simultaneous translation equipment,
mm-hmm.
headphones and all the gear.
Mm-hmm.
So we had every conference room in the facility there set up this way, and they were bilateral discussions of various different topics
mm-hmm.
involving economics and business between the nations.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the plan. Panel discussions, Japanese, American, alternating, everybody with headphones. And we had just begun the program, and the governor had to leave that day because he made his annual appearance at the Pendleton Roundup.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in charge. And ironically, Hank Hickox, who was the GM there, was also off property at the time
mm-hmm.
on Saturday. So I was sitting in the meeting, things were just getting started. One of the staff came to the door and motioned me over. I went over and she said, well, we've received a call from the state police telling us there's been a bomb threat. Someone here has planted a bomb. Now, it was supposed to be pretty, confidential that this was even happening. It was
mm-hmm.
not in the media. It
mm-hmm.
was one of the conditions of hosting. And we had also allowed Judy Rooks from the Oregonian to attend on the condition that she couldn't write about it. She
mm-hmm.
could just be there
mm-hmm.
and sort of observe all of this happening.
Mm-hmm.
And so to have this bomb threat was just one of those strange things, but there was an evolving sort of reaction to the whole idea of Japanese building here and Japanese investment in the U.S., and this is obviously some form of that.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, this is interesting. So I went to the back office at Salishan, and Sandy was working for them at the time. She was based here, but she was their vice president of sales and marketing. And first got the number. I said, I need to speak with the police officer who called you. I need to validate that it was a legitimate call in the first
mm-hmm.
place. So I called and got the phone number. I got a hold of a state police officer. He said it absolutely was. It's a legitimate threat. I'm coming from Newport as fast as I can. I'm
mm-hmm.
on my own. I said, okay, we'll treat it seriously. So, long story short, we had to evacuate all the meeting rooms
mm-hmm.
and all the guest rooms.
Mm-hmm.
We had no idea what was there. When you think about the conditions, any bomb that would be electronically triggered when you have every room full of electronics.
Yeah.
It was just kind of a perfect mix. Yeah. But it was a pleasant day on a Saturday, and we walked everyone out to, you know, where the sunroom was and the deck. And they were all standing out on the grass at the upper end of the driving range, which hadn't yet been shut down. And Norm Winningstad's, I'll always get these two brands confused, and there's a part of story on this too that matters. It's either Augusta or Alouette, the two high-end brands of helicopters, Alouette being the French and Augusta the Italian makers. He owned one or the other. That was just kind of a private chopper. It was also parked at the head of the driving range, as I recall, where he landed that day. So I stood there and explained what we knew, and looking at this incredible array of people.
Yeah.
And standing right in front of me was Judy Rooks taking notes. And I thought, oh no, this is not good. All the work we've done, everything that's here, all these people.
Yeah.
The heads of all the companies that are now located in Oregon, Mr. Hattori himself from Seiko was there. And so we brought out refreshments and said we have to do a thorough examination of the rooms because we can't. And everybody, they took it in stride, as you might guess. And that was kind of the end of the day. But I called Judy in and I said, Judy, we have to talk. You can't be writing this stuff. And she said, well, it's up to the editorial board. I said, really? Okay. Well, how do we deal with that? She said, well, they'll be meeting at 4 o'clock. I said, fine, we have to be on the phone with them at 4. So long story short, we got on the phone and said, you realize this is, does no one any good. And it was obviously not a legitimate. Fortunately, there was no bomb, so they did not write the story. But she and I always had to laugh about that situation because it was kind of a pickle for both of us. So that ended the sessions for the day, and in reality, from that business perspective, I'd say the whole thing was a bit of a a bust. But dinner was great.
That's good.
And one of the more amusing side stories to the whole thing was, I believe it was Mr. Hattori, many of them had driven down in their own cars because they were quite experienced.
Yes.
And if you know the golf course at Salishan, you reach the first tee and the practice green by driving under the freeway
right.
in a tunnel. Well, someone took that, saw Mr. Hattori driving his rented Thunderbird down the cart path that goes in front of the condos on the lower end of Salishan. It took him past the driving range through the tunnel over to the pro shop. And we just had to laugh and say, you know, the roads in Japan are so small, it looks no different than what he drives all the time. So that was kind of an amusing experience, but that was the first, and I have no idea how many sins have ever occurred outside of California or elsewhere. But it was, again, due to the power of the relationship with Morita-san. And there were other things with Mr. Morita along the way, but that was probably one of the most interesting.
Tell me about John Anderson. So he's already there as you come on. The governor's pissed off.
Apparently.
When he leaves. But, you know, you talked about John's secrecy, and I've got great stuff on John's secrecy. But what was he like to work with?
Charismatic, interesting, and you could argue highly professional because he had spent a lot of time in and knew Asia, knew the Japanese, and always at least purported to know a lot. He was an interesting man, interesting person. I wouldn't have just gone down there to go to work for anyone, but I didn't know him beyond having had lunch with him and maybe a little bit by reputation when I went down. So for me, it was all a learning experience after I arrived. And, you know, I realized, like any organization, there were interesting politics going on. And but John was he was good to me. He was demanding, not just to me, but all of the team. But I think he instilled in that group, a sense of potential. And notwithstanding what I don't know that preceded that,
mm-hmm.
he brought, I think, to the department something they maybe had never had before,
mm-hmm.
with that level of sort of knowledge at the right point in time.
Yeah.
When opportunities were there that maybe never had existed, maybe hadn't
yeah.
since. So I don't think you can understate that.
Yeah.
But the flip side of that was he had an interesting ego.
Yeah.
For example, one of the things I sort of found amusing, and oddly, there's a young woman, I can't remember her name, but she was his aide-de-camp. Maybe it was sort of a military thing.
Mm-hmm.
She drove him. She kind of took care of everything.
Mm-hmm.
And he sort of treated it like, you know, to me that was sort of, well, I mean, the governor had a driver, a bodyguard,
yeah.
and lawn, but that's the governor.
Yeah.
John sort of had a mini version of that. Not the same by any means,
mm-hmm.
if you know what I mean. But it was interesting. I found that interesting and amusing. And yet he was good to me and to Sandy, and
mm-hmm.
we got to know each other and his wife, Lynn. But over time, it became clear, the further we got into these, with all these activities, this whole penchant for secrecy was certainly a big part of his life. And
mm-hmm.
it became obvious to me as I got to know the governor better,
mm-hmm.
and certainly Jerry, just how frustrated they were with John's penchant for secrecy.
Yeah, both of them tell stories of telling John, you don't get to use code names here.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm the governor.
But
so.
To him, what the rules he set were the rules
right.
within the agency, and
right.
over there it was a different world.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
from their perspective, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
But John just sort of lived in his own set of codes,
yeah.
so to speak.
Well, it's fascinating because I've been doing the international stuff, but I haven't done the economic development as a whole. Because
mm-hmm.
ATIA is a major player in the legislature when the economic development department is created.
Okay.
So he's there from day one saying, yes, we need this and all this stuff. And then he watches it under, I can't remember if it's under McCall first, but he watches it under Straw, but he doesn't like where it's going.
Yeah.
It's weak.
Yeah.
When he gets in, one of his first changes is whoever's the director of this. And he's not happy with where things, it's just not doing things. But he's also trying to triage the economy, so it's not a priority for him.
Mm-hmm.
During
then
the
first term, yeah.
Yeah, during the first term. And then sometime 82 election,
mm-hmm.
going to 83, it's like, okay,
mm-hmm.
we need to be looking outside and doing
mm-hmm.
this. What do we do? And so John was in Eugene and brought him on board, and there you go. But so that it fits in.
It does.
It fits in with what you were saying.
And the governor didn't quite know what he was getting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's how it goes.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was fascinating because, I mean, I enjoyed working with and for John, and
mm-hmm.
I had would have stuck it out to the end either way.
Yeah.
Because there was so much going on. So for me personally, when he left, it was for a moment or two, it was hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But then when I realized, what have I done?
Yeah.
I've left other things I could do, and I'm down here, and I hadn't been and didn't plan to stay in state government for
right.
any length of time. But he was the only reason I was there. And then when he was gone, it was like, well, that was that.
Yeah.
To have know that he was then going to go back to Washington carrying all of the information and knowledge
exactly.
that he had developed here.
Well, on that fall trip, he's either just before you or just after you at virtually every meeting.
He was. I know. It was crazy. But one of the many letters I found was a wonderful letter from John
mm-hmm.
congratulating us on getting the NKK to
because mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
I'm sure he tried tooth and nail to get
oh, yeah.
down.
Yeah.
One of the other investments that we fought over that they kind of won, I'll say kind of, in the
mm-hmm.
end, was RCA Sharp.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know how much you know about that.
No, so I did put a little thing on it where...
Yeah,
it's good for the Northwest. It's like hell, it's on the other side of the river.
Yeah, I know. Well, and we're the ones who brought it to the Northwest.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we hopped on a jet and went to Princeton.
Yeah.
And I remember was it Kane who was the governor of New Jersey?
It might have been.
And he was very,
yeah.
very welcomed to
yeah.
to the governor, and he provided us with a state police officer
mm-hmm.
and driver for the day. And I remember they took time and showed us around, and when we met with the group, I have the cards in here, but the guy who became important, his name is John Schroyer, and I've never forgotten Schroyer because I got kind of angry at the man,
mm-hmm.
and the basis on which he made his decision.
Mm-hmm.
RCA, Sharp, he was with RCA,
mm-hmm.
but they had made him the point person for this project, and he was mm-hmm. going to be running it.
Mm-hmm.
And he became infatuated with Norm Winningstad and Norm's lifestyle,
mm-hmm.
helicopters, airplanes,
mm-hmm.
etc. And I think he sort of began to fancy himself a bit of that
mm-hmm.
and saw a great opportunity. But we stayed for dinner. We were expecting to fly back that afternoon. They said, no, please spend, we'd like to have dinner with you, which, of course, is a pretty good sign.
Mm-hmm.
Turned out to be a pretty good sign.
Because mm-hmm.
when we learned about it, I think it was Randy Miller, who is the Moore Company here in Portland, who had all these ties as a distributor of Japanese electronics.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who learned that they were doing this. And I think he first learned that they had pretty much selected a site in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when we all...
Yeah.
Launched and went back to say, well, don't make that mistake. You need
yeah.
to come to Oregon.
Yeah.
So we were very successful in getting their attention and their interest. But there was this odd twist with John Schroyer's sort of thinking about other things. And one of the things that became, I think, material to his decisions were taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And the difference in tax structure between the two states.
Yeah.
And one of the sort of... I have to call this a sort of a retribution thought after the fact, was they were promised that the paper mill campus would only remain open another year or two, so that the sight and the smell and the other downsides of it would not be an issue for this beautiful,
uh-huh.
new, expensive plant that
right.
they were going to build.
Right.
It turned out not to be the case.
Not the case at all.
So after they made the decision, and of course Washington, in one of these articles here, claims victory,
mm-hmm.
that was sort of a half victory.
Yeah.
In our
yeah.
view. I always had to chuckle at that because in the end, John kind of got what he deserved.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Sour grapes, I'll admit.
Exactly. The Atiyah's take on it was if it had just been Sharp, they definitely would have come here. If he found the RCA
yeah.
people.
To beat that. And yeah. I think that's a good take on it.
Yeah. And that's also because every time you
personalizing
guys,
it more.
Yeah, exactly. But every time you guys went overseas, the media was always, so what announcements are you going to do?
Yeah.
And the Japan media was doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so this one got great memos 2 or 3 months before the trip to Japan from, I think Doug Fringel is running the office at that point in Tokyo. But
David Luchin was, but he worked for Doug.
Okay.
It's kind of a
yeah.
multifaceted.
But Doug was saying, kind of laying the land and saying, okay, Sharp, you need to talk to him, but no publicity, no nothing, you know, all this kind of stuff, and
mm-hmm.
and you know, all these things, and then it develops in Colorado, and John Anderson gets in kind of late,
yep.
hearing about it, and it's just wild.
Well, and ironically, the RCA component of that disappeared
yeah.
because there is no RCA and
yeah.
it became just Sharp.
Yeah.
So I think the governor's take is accurate,
mm-hmm.
But they had the U.S. side
yeah.
making
you
the
got
decisions.
Your partners. You got your partners.
Yeah, so you win some, you lose some. But
right.
Yeah, so that one came down. Wow. And I'm probably skipping over some things, but NKK became one of the more interesting ones because
mm-hmm.
it happened... and we began down the path, and it was nice. It was, and this is articulated in the article as you're reading as well.
Mm-hmm.
For us, it was a win. Even the potential of it was a win because everything was going into Hillsborough for the
mm-hmm.
most part.
Mm-hmm.
And subsequently, some things went into other communities, and we have Salem and
yeah.
some other
yeah.
places later.
Or Fujitsu builds something, don't ever use it, and it becomes Solo World.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
you know, stuff.
Yeah. Well, and McMinnville got a plant.
Yeah.
And so many
yeah.
of these things that we're building over there that were the suppliers to these companies
yeah.
that we're going to naturally follow were mounting up.
Yeah.
But NKK was a different story.
Mm-hmm.
And to have something that sizable and that important look at a different site, because they needed something a little more heavy industrial.
Mm-hmm.
To look at Millersburg was really quite a victory because
mm-hmm.
we finally got out of the Portland metro area.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were doing everything in our power, and it was all their staff were on board. The site was good, everything was working, but I don't know if you know about the Willamette Industries kink in this thing. Mm-hmm. It's written about in the article, and it's true. But, mm-hmm. And actually, I was pleased that, to be very blunt, I don't remember, wasn't sure when or how we resolved the issues, but the article actually attributes the work of Tia and me and my staff to making this agreement with Willamette Industries. But mm-hmm. the real story went something like this. Willamette had a spur line, a railroad line that ran across the, I think, the southern border of the property that mm-hmm. NKK was buying. It was not in use, hadn't been used for quite some time. They had no intent to use it, but it still mm-hmm. existed. Mm-hmm. Nippon Kokon simply wanted, at their own expense, I believe, to relocate the line mm-hmm. because vibration is mm-hmm. deadly in that industry.
Yeah.
Which we discovered out in Hillsboro. You know, in the old days, you wanted to be near a railroad track. Now you yeah. had to get as far as you could away. So we thought, well, this should not be a big problem. But, you know, Bill Swindells was, I think, chair at the time. Mm-hmm. But, oh goodness, I just went brain dead. Who was the president? He then subsequently went to Weyerhaeuser, and Weyerhaeuser took over Willamette, Rogo, Steve Woke.
Okay.
So I know I went in to their offices in the First Interstate and met with, I believe, both of them, but it became after that me and Steve Rogo. Mm-hmm. And he had an attitude about this, and we were finding this among other Oregon businesses, sort of saying, well, this is nice that you're working with the Japanese, what are you going to do for me? Mm-hmm. And it wasn't infrequent that we got calls saying, well, we have this or that, or we're threatening to move across the river to Washington if we can't get this or that. Usually what working companies wanted was some intervention to help with one or two things, power rates
right.
Or taxes.
Yep.
And I still remember I got the first call from Intel with regard to the massive property tax relief that they received and have been received for many years. Mm-hmm. And I sort of connected them with the treasurer at the time and said, that's an interesting point because industrial property versus industrial land are very different mm-hmm. things. So they had a valid point. Mm-hmm. And the cost of a new factory and the machinery itself was astronomical mm-hmm. and you could kill the entire concept with property taxes the way they were then structured. So I got that. But it wasn't that simple with Willamette. I didn't know what they wanted. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they wanted anything. I think they simply wanted to make it difficult.
Yeah.
Maybe they didn't want a Japanese neighbor. I don't know. But there was no competitive nature. They weren't in the same business. Yeah. Not even close. And you had Teledyne Wachang nearby mm-hmm. and all these other mm-hmm. things, which are actually more collaborative than opposite. But none mm-hmm. of them were in the same business. Mm-hmm. And they drug this thing out. And they were unwilling to bend for no reason I could ever actually articulate. Mm-hmm. If I had my notes, I'm sure there's facts there some kind mm-hmm. somewhere, but they don't stick with me today. And all this was, the clock was ticking and time was going, and we were reaching the end of the year and the end of mm-hmm. the term. And at this point, it was made doubly difficult by other things I've, quite frankly, had forgotten. And this was the acrimonious nature of the Goldschmidt campaign and their team, specifically targeted at my department.
Yeah.
And there's some very humorous things about that at the end of the story that
yeah.
I like. But it's hard to live with when you're doing all this.
Yeah.
And people are critics when they virtually know nothing about yeah. which they're talking.
Yeah. Nothing. I have a great thing on the expo at one point, Goldschmidt. Like, it's early in 86. Mm-hmm. So he's trying to beat Ed Fadeley in the primary.
Oh.
But he talks about tourism needs to be the center of what we're doing, and you know, all those people are going to drive through Oregon to go to a pavilion that we're building for them to learn about what they should do in Oregon. And so when the report is done, and Vic's reading it at the tourism conference that he had every year, mm-hmm. He just goes through and says, well, they first do average visitors stay 4 days mm-hmm. in Oregon, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Not saying incoming governor. What are you going to do? But you need to know that the first day of the Goldschmidt administration, no one had a key to the office. And when they got in, no one knew how to turn on the lights. So Jill Thorne, who had been, she knew her way around,
oh, yeah.
but she figured out where the lights were. And it turns out that Atiyah had given the key to Goldschmidt, who hadn't done anything with it. And I just found the tentative title of the book, although it's too clunky, is Jill Thorne, about 5 months after Goldschmidt's in, Vic sees her, and she says, you know, this job's a lot harder than you made it look. Or a lot tougher than you made it look.
Wow.
But
well, I had, yeah, and Roger Smith, who was the consultant that put in charge of transition team and then became the chair of the commission, and Dick Wrighton, who was on our board later and I got to know quite well, who served and followed me in that job for a short period of time.
Yeah.
Very short. They just, none of them had any idea what had been done or how it had been done.
Did they even transition?
They did, sort of.
Uh-huh.
They tried.
Because there's so much where they didn't even show up to meetings.
No, it was...
In other parts of government.
Oh, I believe it. They focused on it in our area because it was important. It's hard to compare with other areas. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, you know, they definitely had an interest, but they had an attitude.
Yeah.
And as a sidebar, I've got his card in the other room. I think his name is Doug Smith, but I could be wrong, who works at the port right now.
Mm-hmm.
He knew Roger, and he's worked with Roger. And when I ran into him at Dolores Tia's memorial...
Mm-hmm.
Reintroduced himself, and Bill Wyatt and I used to be good friends.
Mm-hmm.
Bill and I and Kate Brown, by the way, skied around Crater Lake together.
Oh, cool.
Kate twice, Bill and me five times. We attempted five times. We failed twice and made it three times in the early 90s.
As a Southern Oregonian, I appreciate that.
And actually, I did it once with some guys from Southern Oregon who were the best partners I ever had because they really knew the place.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved that trip until we decided our knees and other things wouldn't sustain it.
Right.
3 or 4 days of skiing and 60 pounds on your back. But, so this guy works with Bill at the port, which is another interesting story, as I'm sure you know right now. And he said, he called out Roger in our discussion with him there, and I would never say anything to anyone, but he acknowledged who and what Roger was about, and I said, yeah, that was the Roger I knew.
Mm-hmm.
The guy had a big ego, a lot of flash.
Yeah.
But honestly, not one of them knew what they were taking over.
Yeah.
And the stuff I read in the last few, just yesterday, in fact, that came in subsequent articles that they sent. When I walked away from there, I was involved with the Oregon Business Council, and Bill was in for a time after that as president, so I remained involved in those things. But I really, I was so happy to just not have to deal with that element.
Yeah.
At that time, I disavowed most of it until I was reading some of these articles and seeing some of the things that Goldschmidt did to reorganize the department and how he was creating these floating positions who were going to report directly to him and jump over all of
them. What is this, the MX shell game?
Yeah.
With Margaret Carter stomping out.
What a perfect example of what? I don't know.
Yeah.
But, I thought, wow, that's a perfect prescription for disaster because who knows what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And it sort of felt a little that way, but at least at the time we were in NKK's scene, they behaved themselves, I'll say, well.
Mm-hmm.
They knew there was a lot at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually told them, probably Roger, maybe Goldschmidt himself, because we met, that about the problem with Willamette Industries, and said, you know, if we can't resolve this, it's going to be yours to win or lose, essentially, because this is a done deal absent them and that decision.
Mm-hmm.
And was sort of saying, you guys need to be prepared.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if they ever actually get engaged or had to. I just don't remember.
Yeah.
But I do know in the end, we got an acquiescence from Willamette, and we gave them whatever they wanted within reason.
Mm-hmm.
The deal got signed, and then NKK, the markets on silicon on chips started to collapse, and they never built the plant.
Yeah.
They were so apologetic for it that they left the staff person that we got to know so well with an office in Oregon. I don't know if you know this, where he stayed around for some. Luchin and Fringel, of course, continued on with the agency for a time, and David did for a time too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, actually, no. He resigned. I've got his letter, personal letter, telling me about his resignation experience. It's inside. I'll give it to you if you'd like.
Into
the relationship with his new bosses.
Yeah.
There's a little bit of this.
Yeah.
But so they knew the stories. But at that point, I just sort of washed my hands of those things and said, you know, I'm out of here. But they worked with, I think his name is Chris Wada. Anyway, it doesn't matter. But he had an office, I think it was in the World Trade Center, and NKK gave him funds, and his job was to try and do things to leave a positive impression on Oregon, because they lost face so badly in walking away from such a big project.
Yeah. But that's also when chips are turning in from an asset to a commodity.
Exactly.
And all of a sudden, Thailand is the best place to do chips.
Exactly.
And it's just the way of the world.
Yeah.
We're lucky that, you know, Intel says we do this kind of stuff here.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, I mean, and it's amazing to the degree they do, they still do.
Yeah.
So that was sort of the final big event. It was an interesting one to go out on.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Meanwhile, we did have all those other things going on. Intel, who I quickly concluded, in my opinion, they had a valid argument. The question was how it went. And I think that took some time to facilitate, but ultimately worked to their advantage and others.
Mm-hmm.
Other companies, one of the odder cases was in Tualatin. Is it Blue Mountain Pet?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, this was a business in Tualatin, right? Hard to imagine today when you look at what's there. They wanted to save it.
Mm-hmm.
And so the question was, how can we help? And we looked at things, we studied options, and we helped them develop a concept for an employee stock option purchase of the company.
Mm-hmm.
But the buyers wanted to own it, and the new owners didn't really want a factory. They just wanted the market share, and it was going to be a closure anyway.
Yeah.
So it quickly became evident that we couldn't do anything to salvage something that was a private transaction anyway, and probably in the long run, Tualatin's been better off anyway, but nevertheless, it was an example of one of those things you're called in to try and help salvage something that you couldn't. Probably the hardest of any of those kinds of calls came from timber industry, and I'll always remember the time when I got the call from Champion International, who owned five mills in the state of Oregon, and said, we're closing them all. And if I'd known this, it wasn't in very much detail until a few hours or days after that, when I realized our agency, my agency, also had accountability for coordinating a whole series of state services delivered through other agencies at the time of plant closures, predominantly around training and continued benefits. So suddenly we moved from the role of attracting industry to helping close industries.
Yeah.
And, of course, had no idea just what that signal was going to be coming down the road later for Oregon. And as I read my own comments now, as I toured around the state and spoke, you know, you always try to strike a balance between fact and spin, but I believe everything I said was honest and true with regard to my beliefs and our beliefs about the economy and about timber and related industries, and we knew it was changing, we knew it had to become more efficient, we knew that old mills wouldn't survive, new ones would, smaller dimension, metric, all these things were becoming a reality. But, of course, we had no idea, because the first day I heard of the spotted owl was in one of the governor's cabinet sessions in the Monday meeting.
Yeah. It's fascinating, the politics of the spotted owl. People now say the spotted owl did it. It's like, no, it was doing already.
Yeah.
But this just limited your options about what to do next.
It did.
But don't blame the spotted owl for killing off the timber industry. It was...
But it
just limits your options.
But it was complicated. I mean, you had the Canadians, obviously putting.
But they're just now. I saw what Blumenauer and Weidner saying, yelling about Canadian stuff. And it's like, I've got things here from 1955 where you're same thing.
You know, I was. I like to fly fish a lot. Saltwater for. Bonefish permit type of sort of thing, and steelhead, and I took a trip with some friends to northern British Columbia, Smithers, this past October. And while we've been through Vancouver many times, including back in the days in the 86, flying out of there from the direction we did this time, it was astounding again to see the size and the volume of the log rafts that still exist in Vancouver.
Yeah.
And it is such a takes you back to when they were on the Willamette and which is how prevalent they were.
Could walk across Goose Bay.
Yeah. But, you know, to me, the irony of so many of those things was having grown up in the northeastern part of the state, clear cutting was not a factor. Mm-hmm. And the woods harvested there were more predominantly pine than firs. Mm-hmm. And it was a very different kind of forestry that was practiced.
Yeah.
And while it wasn't the spotted owl, it was the same Endangered Species Act and environmentalism that ultimately killed that.
Yeah.
We go back now and I look at land, and I fought fires as a teenager, as a college student, hell attack crew in Hell's Canyon. I mean, I've lived in that country and know it like the back of my hand, if anyone can know anything that big and rugged. But I see it today, and I see what's happened to the timberlands and how unhealthy they are through neglect.
Yeah.
And it's really not even benign neglect. It's worse. So it's the pendulum swung, and it swung so far. I don't know how you ever recover from that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But timber industry here, timber industry there, all of it ultimately, as we well know, became more than anything a footnote in history.
Yeah.
Even though we purport to still have one today, it isn't that much.
Yeah. One of the things I discovered, I haven't done the timber industry part yet, but because it's so vital to Vic's kind of the first 79 when he comes in, it's let's give money back to the taxpayers, let's make a kicker, and then by the end of the year, interest rates have gone up 40%.
Yes.
And so from then on, it's just Katie bar the door, what do we do?
Yeah.
Looking at the timber industry stuff, the huge drop off in employment wasn't in the 80s. Mm-hmm. It was after the oil crisis in the 70s.
In the 70s.
And so it's automation.
Yeah.
We're becoming more efficient.
The need to do so.
Yeah. So we go from, you know, we've got 80,000, 120,000, whatever, and then there's a huge drop.
Mm-hmm.
And then the 80s, 82 takes us down.
Yeah.
Here, but the huge drop had already happened.
Yeah.
Just because of automation.
Yeah.
You're in a global economy, and you want to sell 2x4s. You gotta.
Which is still happening. Ironically, on this trip to BC, one of the guys I was with owns a company. He founded it called Keyknife.
His
partner Russ Lake.
Mm-hmm.
And Keyknife manufactures the cuttering blades that are used in sawmills in his markets throughout the U.S. and the
world.
His steel is manufactured in Germany. And Bob and another gentleman we met there for the first time is from very northern Washington near the Canadian border. And his father, I forget the name of the company, but it was a well-known timber company that no longer exists, owned that company. But he still owns facilities that was owned by the company, and they had some kind of unusual energy contract that allows him to get sort of energy when it's available on a sort of arbitrage basis, and as a result, his business today is running drying systems, kilns, dry kilns, for the timber industry in Canada and northern Washington. And it's just fascinating to see what the business model is,
because
he basically gets kind of free energy, and that's a very expensive part of timber treatment, is to be able to actually dry timber. So it was sort of an interesting revisitation of a topic you don't talk about much, but you had both of these guys, Bob and his view of it, because they ended up knowing each other because they used Bob's products in the middle, and they still are. And his point, both of their points, is the level of automation and the sophistication of a mill today is unrecognizable compared to what anything we ever would have seen.
Yeah, absolutely. This is great. Lots of good stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting to revisit it and know what I remember and what I don't.
Yeah, absolutely.
I do need to ask you a question related to all this stuff. Having touched it, I have to do something with it now, obviously. My question of you would be this, if you can help me at all. My agreement with the archivist.
Ava,
thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Is I said, well, I'll bring stuff down that you may be interested in.
Mm-hmm.
I just have no real sense of what would interest them
every
out of all this stuff.
Damn thing.
Really?
You betcha. The archive, one reason I'm doing this, well, the main reason is the governor asked me to write this biography. But one thing we're doing is, this is a model archive for how to do it. It's cheap digitizing things like they're going out of style. And so everything you've got, and then eventually it's going to be digitized and available for everybody. Now, the organization of that is wacky. I've discovered I need to, like, you guys would put together meeting lists. Mm-hmm. And so I went through and counted for that October 85 trip to Japan. Mm-hmm. You had 45, you actually had 55, but 10 of them got cut out. You did 45 meetings, added in this, all that stuff. So we got all that. But because of the way this whole thing came together, all of this should have gone to the archives.
Yes.
And it didn't.
Yeah.
I interviewed Kate.
Yeah.
And as governor, and we had an interesting conversation about that. But, and so there's just stuff together. So I find when I get memos that you guys wrote or anything, I have to read every single page because at some point it's not the 84 trip, it's the 85 trip, mm-hmm. or this, and so. So anything you can give,
wow.
we would love to have.
Okay.
Anything at all.
Well, here's my sort of thought.
Mm-hmm.
Just the clipping, some of these are duplicative, but most
mm-hmm.
are not.
Mm-hmm.
My goal is going to be to put them in just plastic sleeves in a binder. So at
yep.
least they're sort of, won't be greatly organized. To the degree I can, I thought I would selectively put photographs with them that may tie
sure.
to something.
Sure. And if you want to write just a brief thing, that's good.
Okay.
Because photographs especially, it's like,
what is this?
Who are these people?
I know.
If you would want, you can organize things and I can come back and I can film with my iPad, so we're looking at things. You're telling me a brief thing what it is.
Good.
The governor himself actually would never, usually when an archive comes in,
mm-hmm.
you put it in a U-Haul, the whole thing, he'd give us a box at a time and tell us stories.
Yeah.
And that's, Jerry's kind of doing the same thing.
Okay.
But something like that, just so we have a context. So, like, I'll talk to Jerry,
mm-hmm.
she'll give me a box, I immediately get home, write it up, and it's not much, it's like this much,
mm-hmm.
but it says, here's what's in this box, here's what Jerry says is important,
okay.
here's what I discovered when I went through, that kind of thing.
Well, then my goal is going to be to sort this to, so you only get one of a kind.
yeah.
Not the five versions of the same article.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually, I should just give you my mother's scrapbook. She
yeah, exactly.
Did.
She seems to be very thorough.
Well, she was very thorough, yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe I'll recapture it that way, and along with photographs and other stuff. I mean, you sometimes things have more of a just a personal meaning, but these are kind of interesting, like Consul General.
Oh yeah, those are great.
At NEC, and
did
the governor tell you the story about Sir Henry Ping Fang Fung?
No.
Really?
No.
I've got to tell you too.
Okay.
Hong Kong.
Uh huh.
And fortunately, I came across the invitation sitting here on one of these tables from him, sent to the governor and me when we were at the Mandarin Hotel
mm-hmm.
In Hong Kong. He was returning from the PRC.
Mm-hmm.
And the governor and he had met at the Bohemia Club,
mm-hmm.
which I've now been to myself, which
uh-huh.
has been fun to connect the dots after those years. And Sir Henry actually owned a camp there, or was a member of a camp
uh-huh.
where you buy in.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how they met each other. And Sir Henry learned from the governor somehow that he'd be in Hong Kong, and he sent us this nice engraved invitation
mm-hmm.
asking the governor and me to come to dinner that evening at his home. I think it's Recluse Bay, it's called, over
mm-hmm.
on the other side of Hong Kong, with he and Lady Fung
mm-hmm.
and another couple we were
mm-hmm.
to meet. He came and picked us up, he and his driver, at the hotel, and we drove through the hills. And at the top of this bridge that looks down into Recluse Bay, he stopped to show us the area, and he told us the story, that his father had owned that property on the other side of the bay when he was a boy, but his father had had to sell it at some time, and he'd always wanted it back, and now he owned it again.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were three or four buildings over there. Right out on the point was his home, mm-hmm. where he and Lady Fong resided. There was a swim club, like swimming because it's on the water, a couple of other buildings, sort of club-like buildings. And Sir Henry was Sir, because he was knighted, and he was the first Chinese ever knighted by the Queen of England.
Mm-hmm.
And so we drove down,
mm-hmm.
parked, and we walked, to get to his home, we walked through the building, the swim club, which was what he used as his personal museum to his knighthood.
Mm-hmm.
There was a throne mounted on the wall, it was small, and mm-hmm. all these memorabilia.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went to the home, and we met Lady Fong. And had a the home was like a museum as well. The
yeah.
artifacts were astounding. And the couple we met were from Portland. And what we learned was that their son was married to the Fung's daughter. Their son was a professional tennis player.
Mm-hmm.
And they happened to be in town because the Davis Cup matches for Hong Kong were being played as we were there.
Mm-hmm.
But we went next door after cocktails. We went to the, of course, the governor never drank, so, as I'm sure you know.
I have actually, after the fall 84 trip mm-hmm. in Hong Kong, he apparently had a few firewaters.
Ah.
I talked with Bill Campbell, who was yeah. on a no drinking binge on that trip.
At that time.
But eventually had to drink in Japan because I think Doug Pringle took him to a place that he said, I have to drink if I'm going to eat this food.
Well, there is that. And there was a lot of that in Japan.
Yeah. But yeah.
So anyway, we went next door and had dinner with this other couple, six mm-hmm. of us. And I also found a note, without absent the tickets, but a note from, I guess, his daughter. Phone with accompanying two tickets to the Davis Cup matches the next day
mm-hmm.
that she sent to me at the hotel and mm-hmm. said, we hope you and the governor can use these.
Mm-hmm.
So our plan was to go join them in the family box and watch yeah. the tennis, but it was outdoor and it rained.
Oh, well, there you go.
So we never got a chance to go. Well, that was, and Sir Henry was a fascinating character. Somewhere in my stash of business cards, I've got at least two or three for him of some of his businesses. And the one mm-hmm. that stuck with me, the two that stuck with me, were Thomas Cook Travel, which is the largest, mm-hmm. probably the largest travel operator in the world, a British company.
Mm-hmm.
And he owned the the Far East
mm-hmm.
franchise
mm-hmm.
for Thomas Cook.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was Aiwa Electronics, which I believe is a sister or subsidiary company of Sony.
Mm-hmm.
And so both of those were companies that he owned or managed. So all that was a magnificent story, but what I also have is an article in this pile that told of the financial demise of the family,
mm-hmm.
not many years after. And what was going on when we met him is he had turned, one of his sons, I believe, is a physician, and one was on the ruling council, like the city council of
mm-hmm.
Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
And he had turned his business affairs over to his sons, and they pretty much, according to this article, ran it into the ground.
Hmm.
They took on debt. They got too many businesses,
mm-hmm.
too many investments in too many things, and they mismanaged them.
Hmm.
And literally at the time this article was written, they were struggling every day to figure out how they were going to salvage the debt. There were other key players we met during this time who were Hong Kong related. K.T. Chong.
Mm-hmm.
is one that comes to mind. And I remember when we were in Hong Kong, we saw his building,
mm-hmm.
which was gold-plated appearance glass,
mm-hmm.
the K.T. Chong Tower. He was a timber man,
mm-hmm.
and he bought, exported, and moved timber, both hardwood from Asia as well as from here, which
mm-hmm.
is why I had an Oregon interest. His representative in Oregon once approached me at the beginning of the Chinese expats leaving to try and salvage
mm-hmm.
their wealth before the
Yeah.
Hong Kong reverted to Chinese rule. And of course, this is what was starting to happen, had been
so
going on.
In the first influx there, weren't you?
Yeah. And well, and in
yeah.
BC, it was going on.
In big numbers.
Right around Expo 86. It was
yeah.
all beginning.
Yeah.
He approached me with a request for my insight and
mm-hmm.
any information on a proposal, which would have been to build essentially a community in Oregon for Hong Kong expats.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you think about U.S. versus Canadian and other immigration requirements
mm-hmm.
that would have been very complicated to make
yeah.
happen. it's a fascinating concept, but I don't think it ever quite happened
yeah.
in Oregon. But so there are so many different dimensions of different kinds of things going back.
Which is fascinating. It could have put it by Vancouver and reclaimed it for the crown.
Yeah, exactly. And all this, that even made it more interesting just because of our, at the time, visible ties to seeing what was going on up there. And you can picture what they were doing there and how it would go. Yeah. There'd be an office, or I mean, a condo tower.
Yeah.
Long before they became what they are in Portland today. So, yeah, that was fun. And then the other story that I have to share, because it's Sandy and me and our son Justin, was Expo 86, Oregon Day, which is in many of the photos.
May 24th.
Well, that was the day that we were to go up, and we gave speeches, and they had a parade and all the things in our honor. And
the world's largest strawberry shortcake.
Yes. Many people ate. Well, to go together, the governor and Mrs. Atiyah, Sandy and I, and our son, who was probably 12, went together in a private plane. Lon Holbrook went with us. So we got into Vancouver, and we have a photo of Lon and our assigned RCMP standing there with our son in handcuffs. Just a photo op.
Yeah.
And his first and so far only arrest to the best of our knowledge. But he's 43 now, so he's on his own. So we stayed together. If you read the report, it's interesting because Bob Stevens, do you know anything about Bob? Bob's a guy we hired to manage Expo 86.
Okay.
And he really did a remarkable job.
I think I saw his name in a Julie Tripp article.
Yeah. And he articulates, so the report's very thorough and it's very good. And there's a story in there where a part of the report talks about the real estate that we rented there. And, and one of the things that we rented there was this mansion in the old sort of Dunthorpe area. They were starting to go through a whole sort of rehab. But we used that because we could put like 30 people in there because we had all these young people and volunteers who stayed up there. And then we leased a couple of other homes and condos. Well, Bob had like a duplex, I believe, out in this residential area. So we stayed there with the Atiyahs and Sandy and Justin and me. And Sandy always remembers getting up the day we were going to leave and having Dolores say, please strip your sheets off the bed and we'll wash them before we leave, which we thought was just perfectly symbolic.
Given the house that they had to live in on Winter Street, it sounds exactly right.
And I had this photo I came across. That was kind of fun. But, I mean, that was so typical of them and her.
Yeah, yeah. So down to earth.
You don't need all that. So this is the crew that was
sort
of permanent there.
Yeah, some of the 80.
So this was Bob. And from a personal standpoint, this is my cousin, Lisa Dawson. Lisa's younger than me, about a dozen years, grew up in Joseph, had just graduated from UPA, University of Puget Sound. So hadn't yet struck out into a new job, and we were hiring all these young students and all, and Bob hired Lisa, and she was one of his, she was volunteer coordinator for Expo 86. Lisa has spent her entire adult life running the economic development organizations in Wallowa and Union, Baker County.
Great.
So she, this was beginning what for her became a a lifelong.
That's fantastic.
Career. So we had various connections to the place. I don't know. I could always you can always talk forever, but that
yeah.
sort of gives you the.
That's good. Good stuff.
So what I will do with this is, as I said, try to organize it.